Welcome to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 25, a lecture entitled German Opera Comes of Age. First, my friends, early German opera, a very quick history. German language opera, as an internationally recognized genre of opera, distinct then from the Italian and French operas we have studied, came into being in 1791 with the creation and production of Mozart's The Magic Flute. By comparison, Italian opera came into being in 1600 with Peri's Eurydice, perhaps even earlier with Peri's Daphne. So there's been at least 191 years from the creation of the first internationally recognized Italian opera to the first such German opera. A distinctly French opera came into being in 1669, at least a French operatic institution, the Royal Academy of Paris. That's 122 years before the Magic Flute. Well, the Germans really seem to be carrying up the tail end on this one, so we must ask ourselves the question, why so late? Why did it take so long for a distinctly German operatic school to evolve? As usual, the answer has to do with national spirit and language. First, national spirit. Despite the fact that Italian opera was a popular form of entertainment at German courts, the overblown and improbable nature of these operas simply did not resonate with the more serious and logical nature of the German artistic intellectual community. Now, indeed, this sounds like I'm stereotyping, and I am, but it's necessary that we do this. Look, let me extend this question and get provincial for a moment. Let's pretend that this is post-revolutionary United States, 1785. What sort of operas would composers in America be composing if they were composing operas in 1785? Would the overblown characters of Italian opera seria or the silly yet wonderful plots of Italian opera buffa appeal to the young nation of the United States? Would there be a community to watch these operas, to create these operas, to perform these operas? No, I would say not. At that time, America was nation-building. It was a young, energized, mercantile nation beginning to push at its frontiers. The overblown character of Italian opera seria, the silly and entertaining character of Italian opera buffa, had nothing in common with the spirit of America in 1785. So while some people in 1785 in Philadelphia or New York might have chosen to consume Italian opera as entertainment, the huge edifice and structures you need to create, perform, and sustain opera as a tradition would not have existed then, at least not have existed for the arcanity of Italian opera seria and buffa. So national spirit does have a lot to do with the kind of operas someone writes in a country. Now, I said the other reason why German language opera evolved late had to do with language. And this is a very important point that I'm going to spend a couple of minutes here. Look, 17th and 18th century Italian opera was dominated by singers. We've talked about that, by singers. Italian operatic singing style, by definition, requires huge, fat, endless vowels, with which we need to develop tone, expression, and virtuoso coloratura. Italian singing is in the vowels. That's where everything takes place, my friends. We need just enough consonants to clearly articulate and separate the vowels. This is singing as it evolved in Italy, and this is opera singing as it evolved in Italy, and Italian opera singing is the standard. Now, the Italian language, with its perfect balance of vowel and consonant, could not have been better designed if we had tried a million times over ourselves. Let's just take one Italian word, the word for Italian. Italiano. Now, let's just play with that word a little bit, shall we? It's got four wonderful vowels. Italiano. Italiano, Italiano, Italiano. Oh my goodness, we could play with that any way we like. The consonants are clean enough to clearly separate these four vowels from each other, but they don't get in the way. They're not harsh and they're not brutal. We could sustain any one of those vowels or all of those vowels as long as we wanted by a device called melisma. Melisma is when we attach many different pitches to a single syllable. Italiano. That was a melisma. Not a pretty one, but a melisma nevertheless. The point is, opera singing, by definition, is Italian singing. And Italian singing, by definition, is melisma, is coloratura, is beautiful, long, juicy vowels, cleanly and clearly separated by elegant consonants. Now, let's compare this briefly to French. How would we say French? Well, let's say français. Now, this is a whole different story, my friends. Français. The consonants are not sharp and clear. They kind of blur into the vowels themselves, as does so much of the French language. It is a blurred and a wonderfully colored language, but it is not one of sharp and clean articulation. Now, composers of French opera had to deal with this difference of the French language from the Italian language right away. Francais. It's not a language given to long melisma, not like Italian. The vowels are there, but if we go on too long on a vowel in French, we're going to lose the meaning of the word because the consonants aren't clear enough to rescue the vowels, frankly. It's true. So as Italian aria evolves, we've talked about this, Italian arias have much less coloratura than Italian arias, and French arias have much less coloratura than Italian arias. And additionally, French recitative is a little more melodic than Italian recitative, because when you're kind of talking in French, then you can doctor it up a little more. The reason why French singing style in French opera evolves differently from Italian has to do with the nature of the language. And until French composers, or at least Jean-Baptiste Lully, an Italian-born composer who showed the French how to use their own language properly, until French composers adapted their composing style to the realities of their language, French opera would only be a mimic, a mirror, a poor one at that of Italian singing style and Italian opera. So French opera comes into its own as soon as a proper French declamatory style is achieved, and that's achieved by Lully. Now, back to where we are today, apropos of German opera. Look, say what you like about the French language, but it's still a Romance language, that is a Roman-based language, and it shares much in common with Italian. Italiano. Francais. Deutsch! Now, that, my friends, is a whole new ball game. Deutsch! Where, oh, where do we put melisma in German? Oh, I don't know. Deutsch! Oh, no. This is a language dominated by consonants, dominated by articulation, dominated by attack, a spiky language of understated vowel and overwhelming consonants. It is not a language given to melisma. How are we going to do traditional Italian singing style filled with coloratura, filled with melisma in the German language? We're not. We could try to force that Italian singing style onto the German language, and that's what was done during the 1600s and 1700s, but that's not German opera. That's just Italian opera being sung poorly in German. We've all had the experience, by the way, I trust we've all had the experience, because we should have it once, of hearing an Italian opera sung in English. And it sounds stupid, aside from the fact that we actually understand the words, and it comes as a shock sometimes to hear how dumb these words really are. We also hear a language not suited to the melisma that was properly written for a very different sort of language. English is a Germanic language, and of course, German, filled with consonants and short vowels, cannot be used in an Italian style. I mention all of this because true German opera, in terms of both singing style and the nature of its plots, will have to evolve from native German roots and not by imitating and adapting Italian opera as the French essentially did in creating a French national opera. Please, German singing style demands what we call a syllabic setting. That is, one pitch per syllable, one syllable per pitch, as opposed to the melismatic settings of Italian opera. Do you remember, by the way, when we talked about the War of the Buffoons and Rousseau made that statement that the French language was not suited to opera singing? This is all he was talking about. And of course, it wasn't really true. The French language can be adapted to opera singing. But what he was saying is that the French language was not Italian. And that's true. No language is Italian. But my friends, if the French language is not Italian, then the German language is Martian. And again, until a specific kind of singing style based on the nature of the German language can evolve, one that is syllabic in its setting, we're not going to have a true German operatic tradition. And so German opera will not evolve from Italian opera or from French opera. German opera is going to have to evolve from native German roots that already accept the nature of the German language. Which brings us to Singspiel. Singspiel. Literally, sing play, or a play with singing. This is a German play with music. Singspiel is a very general word. In the 17th century, this word was applied to virtually any stage work that included music, vocal music, from song and dance troupes to Italian opera. Singspiel, as we understand the word properly today, is a partly sung, partly spoken German theatrical genre that had its roots in popular culture. Very important statement. I'm going to say it again. Singspiel, as we understand the word today, is a partly sung, partly spoken German theatrical genre that had its roots in popular German culture. Now, in England, such a partly sung, partly spoken theatrical work would be called a ballad opera, or an operetta. In France, such a work would be part of the tradition of opera comique. In the United States, we would call such a work a musical or a musical show. There is no equivalent in Italian musical theater, as all Italian works, light or heavy, serious or comic, are sung in their entirety. So the Italian tradition is a completely sung one, and almost every other national tradition includes some degree of spoken dialogue. Mozart's Singspiel, The Rescue from the Harem of 1782, Die Entführung aus dem Serail, is a romantic comic adventure and rescue story. So it's one of these Singspiels, and it's meant to be a popular entertainment. Though the subject had been treated many times by many different composers and librettists, according to historian Claude Poliska, Mozart in one stroke raised the German Singspiel into the realm of great art without altering any of its established features. So in 1782, with his piece The Rescue from the Harem, Mozart takes a popular and common entertainment and elevates it because of his extraordinary talent. And it is Mozart's use of Singspiel that will put German opera on the map. Again, a genre that evolves from common German roots, heightened and elevated by a great composer, becomes an internationally recognized operatic form. And of course, it is the Magic Flute, which was also a Singspiel of 1791, that puts German opera on the international map. It's the last major work that Mozart completed. Its first performance was September 30th of 1791. Mozart would be dead in less than 3 months. It was commissioned by librettist, director, actor Emanuel Schikaneder, who also wrote the libretto, or a good portion of the libretto. Schikaneder took credit for writing the libretto of Magic Flute, but history has proven him a bit conceited in this one. Others had a hand in it. Indeed, Mozart probably also had a major hand in preparing this libretto. But we give Schikaneder credit as librettist nevertheless. He was also the first Papageno in the opening production. Now, this piece was commissioned for performance, the Magic Flute was, at a Burgtheater, that is, at a music hall, as opposed to the Hofstheater, the Imperial Opera House, where The Marriage of Figaro was produced. So the Burgtheater meant that this was meant, the Magic Flute, for middle and lower middle class entertainment, as popular entertainment. Again, Mozart, through his incredible talent and art, elevates a popular form to a level theretofore unimagined. He's working within a German tradition, but the tradition becomes operatic in its substance due to his talent. All right, the plot of The Magic Flute, which is that first internationally recognized German opera, and that's why we start German opera with The Magic Flute. The plot is half fairy tale and half morality play. First, the fairy tale part. The Magic Flute is filled with strange, exotic, and supernatural people, beings, and animals. The action takes place in an ancient Egyptian fantasy world. My kids loved and still love The Magic Flute because of the dancing animals and the strange scenes and the weird costumes and wonderful creatures. So it's got an exotic fairy tale element to it. But it also is a subtle and profound morality play. It's about Masonic initiation ritual and Enlightenment ideals. Schikaneder and Mozart were Masonic brothers, and they both believed, as so many Enlightenment people did, in the message of brotherhood and Masonry. And so The Magic Flute is about Masonic initiation rites, and it's filled with Masonic symbolism and devices. Now, we would need days and days to go through these, so I won't. Let's just talk about the music, and we'll listen to one of the numbers. The music is brilliant. It's Mozart. We could expect nothing else. And much of it is quite popular in that it is meant for a popular audience. It's popular as befits a Burgtheater Singspiel. For example, the entrance aria for Papageno, the Birdcatcher. All right, the action up to this point, please. Tamino, a stranger in this strange land, is being pursued by a huge, and we assume, a hungry serpent. And this is how the Singspiel begins. Some strange, weird concoction, probably people inside a costume that looks like a snake, running after this poor guy dressed as a Japanese in the middle of this Egyptian scene. Strange, wonderful, and bizarre. All right, what does our hero do at this moment? He faints out of fear. Very macho. Indeed, Tamino's learning to be a man is a lot of what this opera is about. Then three mysterious ladies appear out of nowhere, and together they slay the snake. Yes, all sorts of Freudian imagery comes to mind here. We'll keep that out for now as well. And then, having admired the unconscious Tamino, this wonderful stud, they exit. Tamino awakens, frankly surprised to be alive. And then he speaks the following dialogue. Regaining consciousness, looks around, frightened. Where am I? Is it a fantasy that I'm still alive? He rises and looks around. That awful snake dead at my feet? The sound of panpipes is heard in the distance. What do I hear? He withdraws and observes. Papageno, dressed in a suit of feathers, hurries by, carrying a large bird cage on his back and a panpipe in his hands. We hear a longish introduction, which allows Papageno time to make his entrance. Prominent is the panpipe motive he plays to attract birds. When he reaches the center of the stage, he begins to tell us about himself in a number that has the easygoing gait of popular Viennese music. This melody quickly attained folk song status. I am a man of widespread fame, and Papageno is my name. To tell you all in simple words, I make my living catching birds. The moment they attract my eye, I spread my net, and in they fly. I whistle on my pipe of pan. In short, I am a happy man. He whistles and then removes the cage from his back. Second verse, essentially the same as the first. Although I am a happy man, I also have a future plan. I dearly love my feathered friends, but that's not where my interest ends. To tell the truth, I'd like to find a pretty girl of my own kind. In fact, I'd like to fill my net with all the pretty girls I met. Third verse, same as the first. Essentially the same, none the worst. Once all the girls were in my net, I'd keep the fairest for my pet, my sweetheart and my bride-to-be to love and cherish tenderly. I'd bring her cake and sugar plums and be content to eat the crumbs. She'd share my little nest with me. A happier pair could never be. He whistles and turns to leave. Simple, absolutely straightforward form. It's what we call a strophic song, the same music three times, each time to different words. Folkish, direct melody of indescribable charm and grace. And then more spoken dialogue. Tamino steps out from his hiding spot and says, "Hey there!" Papageno is taken aback. "Who's there?" Tamino, "Tell me who you are, my jolly friend." And Papageno says, "Who I am?" "Well, silly question." "A man like you." Let's listen to this, and here's what I want you to be aware of while we listen. I want you to notice the folk-like directness of this tune and its simple phrase structure. A prime, A double prime, the same music three times. I want you to note how it well defines the rustic Papageno. Such music, point three, will have a direct effect on a popular audience. They're going to get it right away. Please note the syllabic setting. Is this an aria or a song? Well, it's Mozart, so we call it an aria. But frankly, there's a syllable for every pitch, a pitch for every syllable. This is pure German-style singing. No melisma here. And also, please note the spoken dialogue. There is no secco recitative.
Wo bin ich? Ist's Fantasie? Dass ich noch lebe? Die Schlange tot? Was höre ich? Ich Vogelfänger bin bekannt bei alt und jung im ganzen Land. Weiß mit dem Locken umzugehen und mich aus Zweifel zu verstehen. Drum kann ich froh lustig sein, denn alle Vögel sind ja mein. Der Vogelfänger bin ich ja, stets lustig, heißer Hopsassa. Ich Vogelfänger bin bekannt bei alt und jung im ganzen Land. Ein Netz für Mädchen möchte ich, ich fing sie guten Weiß für mich. Dann sperrte ich sie bei mir ein und alle Mädchen wählen rein. So tauschte ich brav Zucker ein, ihr welchen ihr am liebsten wär, dem geb ich gleich den Zucker her. Und küsste sie mich zärtlich dann, wär sie mein Weib und ich ihr Mann. Sie schlief an meiner Seite ein, ich wiegte wie ein Kind sie ein.
du lustiger Freund, wer du bist.
Wer ich bin? Dumme Frage. Ein Mensch wie du.
Some quick conclusions, please. A distinctly German language, internationally recognized opera tradition develops late in the 18th century. This operatic tradition grows out of the popular tradition of Singspiel. The melodies are well fitted to the characteristics of the German language, and spoken dialogue is heard in place of secco recitative. By the way, I have to make a point here. Recitative is not part of the German tradition. However, if we listen to the cantatas and masses of Bach, let's say, written 50 years before the Magic Flute, we hear lots of recitative. I want to make a point. Even though Bach is working in German, he's using aspects of the Italian style. And that Italian style will not last in German music into the 19th century and even beyond. Rather, 19th century German opera, which becomes so important and so influential and so essential to the modern repertoire, will develop from Singspiel. It will not develop from Germanic imitations of Italian operatic style like Bach's incredible cantatas and masses. So Bach's cantatas and masses, for example, represent an evolutionary dead end in terms of the large-scale development of German opera. That's not to say they're not magnificent. They are. They're among the best pieces of music ever written, anytime, any place, anybody. But in terms of evolution, they represent themselves a dead end. It is Singspiel, with its spoken dialogue and syllabic settings of the German language, which will become the basis for the international German tradition. I would also point out that plots and storylines of these Singspiels are generally drawn from German folk stories and folk imagery that show a distinct preference for supernatural characters and situations. So, out of this grows 19th century German opera, which becomes an experimental, cutting-edge operatic tradition. The reason there is so much experimentation in 19th century German opera, unlike opera in Italy and France, there is no long-standing operatic tradition, and there's no operatic industry, which needs to be fed tremendous amounts of money. Look, everything operatic in Germany is pretty much new in the early 19th century, so romantic trends flourish. Experimentation flourishes in the context of German opera in the 19th century. Now, quickly, a quick couple of words, because many of you are probably thinking, he's skipping Fidelio? He's skipping Beethoven? Yes, I'm skipping Fidelio. Fidelio was written in 1805 and was revamped for reperformance in 1814. Why am I skipping Beethoven? Because this is an Italian-style opera written on a French subject. I'm also skipping Italian-language opera. We're not hearing any Purcell. We're not hearing any Benjamin Britten. We're not hearing Tommy by The Who. We're not doing any American opera. I would love to do Porgy and Bess, but we're not doing American opera either. Listen, my choice of operas during this course, and of course it's been a very difficult thing to decide, has been guided by the international repertoire. There's been no time for sleepers. There's been no time for obscure, though worthy operas by composers like Spontini and Piccinni. There's been no time for many, many incredibly important operas. I mean, there's no Purcell, no Handel, no Offenbach, Mascagni, Berlioz, Massenet, Donizetti, Gounod, Rimsky-Korsakov, Shostakovich, Berg. I've done no Czech opera by Dvorak or Janáček. I've done no Hungarian opera. I've done no Spanish opera. I've done almost no 20th century opera. Neither has this course taken into account set design, costuming, or specific singers, or for that matter, specific directors like Poncel and Zeffirelli and Peter Sellers, who has produced a Don Giovanni, which takes place in the south of Bronx. He's also produced a Così fan tutte, which takes place in a diner. The reason why I haven't talked about these aspects of set design and costuming and singers and directors is because they are production dependent. If we don't see that specific singer in that specific costume in that specific production, then what I'm giving you is essentially meaningless. Words and music have been my guide, and the concept of composer and dramatist has been my mantra. So let's continue with the understanding that I'm leaving out more than I'm including. So be it. the character of 19th century German opera. The definitive work that established German Romantic opera was Weber's Der Freischütz, literally the free shooter, but we generally call this opera the Magic Bullets, first performed in Berlin in 1821. Now, the characteristics of German Romantic opera as exemplified by Der Freischütz. 6 points, and as I give you these 6 points, please compare these characteristics to what we now know about Rossini and Verdi and Italian 19th century opera. German Romantic opera, point number one, the plots are drawn from medieval history, legend, or fairy tale. Point two, the stories typically involve supernatural beings and happenings. Point three, the stories lay stress on a background of wild, mysterious, and uncontrolled nature. Point four, supernatural incidents are not incidental but essential plot elements intertwined with the fate of human characters. Point number five. Excuse me. Human characters often become agents for supernatural forces. Their conflict represents the conflict of good and evil. And point six, the triumph of good over evil is interpreted in terms of salvation or redemption, a concept with vaguely religious overtones. Now, does this sound anything like the people-oriented opera of Italy? No, nothing. Opera in Italy deals with human emotions, human relationships in the 19th century. Opera in Germany, a completely different bag of shells, if you'll excuse me. All right, Carl Maria von Weber, 1786 to 1826. Harold Schoenberg tells us, to the early Romantics, the big man, Beethoven always excluded, my friends, was Carl Maria von Weber, and a good case can be made for him as the first of the true Romantics. Today, very little of Weber remains in the repertoire except for Der Freischütz. Thus, it's hard to realize the overwhelming impact of Weber on the oncoming Romantics, on Mendelssohn, on Berlioz, on Liszt, and especially on Wagner. If any single composition can be said to have set off the Romantic age of music, it was Der Freischütz, in particular the scene at the Wolf's Glen, with its mysterious enchantment, its evocation of the power of evil, its nature painting and color, its power and imagination, all hit Europe with tremendous force. And we're about to sample two excerpts from this famous Wolf's Glen scene. Now, Der Freischütz illustrates perfectly the trends and content of pre-Wagner 19th century German opera. There are four main characters. Samuel is a wild huntsman, the devil in disguise. Max is a young huntsman in love with Agatha, the daughter of the hereditary forester. And Caspar is a friend who has already sold his soul to Samuel. Quickly, the story. Samuel has already bought the soul of Caspar. Max, the young huntsman, is in love with Agatha, but to gain her hand, he must win a shooting contest. Recently, his aim has gone off, and he's panicked. And so he approaches his friend Caspar, and Caspar says, I can help you. Samuel can help you, but we must go to the Wolf's Glen in order to make magic bullets. They make the bullets in this horrific scene, but of course, six of the bullets will strike their target. The seventh is made to spin around and kill Agatha. Of course, that doesn't happen. It almost kills Agatha, but instead that seventh bullet during the contest strikes Caspar, the guy who dragged Max into all of this, and Caspar dies, really. It's just, ugh, yeesh, ugh, horrible, writhing, unhappy, painful death. Max admits what he's done, he's pardoned, and he's allowed to marry Agatha if he behaves himself for 1 year. So there's a happy ending. Good triumphs over evil. The plot is drawn from legend and fairy tale. The story involves supernatural beings. Supernatural incidents are not incidental to the plot, but essential to the plot. The human characters are agents of supernatural elements, and indeed, triumph of good over evil marks the conclusion. We could have said all the same things, by the way, about the magic flute. All right. German opera is about the supernatural, the metaphysical, the allegorical. Italian 19th century opera is about people. The Wolf's Glen scene, a model depiction of supernatural horror, the casting place of the bullets. I set the scene. A frightful glen with a waterfall, a pallid full moon, a storm is brewing. In the foreground, a withered tree shattered by lightning seems to glow. In other trees, owls, ravens, and wild birds. Casper, without a hat or coat, but with a hunting pouch and knife, is laying out a circle of black field stones, in the center of which lies a skull. A few steps away, a hacked-off eagle wing, a ladle, and bullet molds. We hear a chorus of invisible spirits set a terrifying mood, but we move on to the invocation of Samiel. Casper whispers, "Samiel! Samiel! Appear! By the wizard's skullbone, Samiel! Samiel! Appear!" Samiel virtually steps out of a rock. Oh, stage design was something in those days. "Was rufst du mich? Why do you call me?" Casper throws himself at Samiel's feet. "You know that my days of grace are coming to an end. Tomorrow. Will you extend them once more?" "No." "I bring you new sacrifices." "Which ones?" "My hunting companion. He approaches, who has never before set foot in your dark kingdom."
"What does he want?"
"Magic bullets, in which he puts his hope."
"Six strike, seven deceive."
"The seventh is yours. From his own gun it will aim at his bride. It will drive him to despair, both he and his father."
"I side with neither party."
"Will he be sufficient for you?"
"Perhaps."
"If you grant me grace for another 3 years, I will bring you to him as prey."
"So be it. By the gates of hell, tomorrow, he or you."
And Samiel disappears amidst thunder. Also, the skull and knife disappear. In their place, a small stove with glowing coals is seen. Now, is this scene recitative, aria, or parlante? It's neither. We have three different kinds of vocalization. We have the whispering from Casper at the beginning. Samiel, the devil, never sings. He only speaks. And then Casper sings. So we have singing, whispering, and speaking, all accompanied by skittish orchestral strings that illustrate well the drama with a very dissonance-filled orchestral background. Please, let's listen to this combination of singing and speaking that comes, as it does, out of the Singspielsch tradition.
Bei dem Trompeten Hölle, morgen ihr
All right, Max arrives at the hellhole. He sees terrifying images. His dead mother's ghost urges him to flee. He sees an apparition of a crazed Agatha as she leaps off a cliff. But he's undeterred. Frightened? But I must have those bullets! So the scene begins with the casting of the bullets. Casper takes the ingredients from his pouch and throws them into the stove, one by one. First, then, the lead. Then this piece of glass from a broken church window, some mercury, three balls that have already hit the mark, the right eye of a lapwing, and the left of a lynx. Probatum est. Now to bless the bullets. And whether this is alchemy or Julia Child, we know something terrible is being mixed up in this pot. And the section that follows is the melodrama. A melodrama is a combination of singing and speaking, usually more speaking than singing, with a constant orchestral accompaniment. Yes, as the bullets are cast, we hear speaking and we hear this terrific background music as each bullet is accompanied by some other vision of terrifying supernatural horror. The melodrama begins. Casper, pausing three times, bowing to the earth. Hunter who watches in the darkness, Samuel, Samuel, pay attention. Stay with me through this night until the magic is achieved. Anoint for me the herbs and lead. Bless the 7, 9, and 3 so that the bullets will be fit. Samuel, Samuel, come to me. Casts the first bullet, which drops in the pan. Eins! And an echo repeats, Eins! Nightbirds crowd the fire. Zwei! The echo repeats, Zwei! A black boar passes. Dadai! The echo, Dadai! A storm starts to rage. Of course, Casper's getting anxious. Veer! The echo, veer! Cracking of whips and the sound of galloping horses is heard. More and more alarmed becomes Casper. Foomf! Foomf! Dogs barking and horses neighing are heard. Yes, the devil's own hunt. Woe is me, the wild chase. And then the devil's chorus. Through hill and dale, through glen and mire, through dew and cloud, storm and night, through marsh, swamp, and chasm, through fire, earth, sea, and air. Yo, ho, wo, 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 jo, ho, wo, wo, ho, 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 ho. Zax! Zax! Deepest darkness, the storm lashes with terrific force. Samuel, 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 help! Samuel appears. Max almost falls and he grabs onto the dead tree. Suddenly the dead tree turns into Samuel. Max is thrown to the ground. Casper is thrown to the ground. And Samuel repeats, Hier bin ich. Here I am. Oh boy. Goosebump City. Let's listen. Melodrama.
Samuel, hab Acht, steh mir bei in dieser Nacht, bis der Zauber ist vollbracht. Salbe mir so Kraut als Blei, segne 7, 9 und 3, dass die Kugel tüchtig sei.
Samuel, Samuel, herbei.
Eins.
My friends, this is completely different from contemporary Italian bel canto opera in terms of use of the voice, syllabic setting with no recitative, expressive content dealing with supernatural events, and compositional technique. Carl Maria von Weber wrote that opera is a work of art, complete within itself, in which all the related parts and contributions are blended together and thus disappear, and somehow, in disappearing, form a new world. He's aware of opera as synthesis. Indeed, 19th century German opera will create whole new worlds. We move on to Richard Wagner. Thank you.